The following episode of K-Voice was recorded at 12:22 a.m., October 27th, 2017. Things may have changed by the time you listen to this show. Enjoy the show.
When we come to see the teddy bear, he to play.
National proportions. A terrifying dream where conservatives have seized power of all factions of the government.
And I don't mean conservatives we are used to.
Oh, no, no, no!
These conservatives are the bottom-feeding, foulest creatures one can imagine. In a world where a madman and champion of the KKK is president, and where conservative fake news runs the country,
how shall good triumph over evil?
How will ignorance be defeated?
Only time will tell.
Are you strong enough to join the fight? Are you brave enough to stand up against such odds? Are you?
I have a secret to tell you. This is no dream, my friends.
This is your life.
This is your life.
Hello. Thank you for listening to K-Voice of Resistance. I am your terrified host, Kelly, for many reasons, but check this one out. The Republican anarchist Ajit Pai, FCC chairman, is abolishing regulations,
as is the running fad in Washington these days.
On Wednesday, this hateful cretin announced that the commission will vote next week to strike down rules preserving media diversity in local markets. Some of these rules date back to the 1970s. And on Tuesday, the FCC voted to eliminate a 77-year-old rule requiring that TV and radio stations operate a physical studio in the areas where they are licensed. And Ajit Pai
and his Republican FCC
dealt a death blow to local media and a well-informed society in early August when news broke out of another rule change initiated by Pai that would allow a Sinclair Tribune merger, effectively broadcasting Sinclair-endorsed content into 72% of American households. All these policy shifts significantly benefit the right-wing Sinclair Broadcast Group, whose,
surprise, surprise,
reported close ties with Pai have raised concerns as the federal government reviews Sinclair's proposed $3.9 billion merger with Tribune Media. Broadcasters will no longer be responsive to their communities, they won't be a part of their communities, and they'll be exploiting the trust that people have in their local news. They're looking to hire, guess who? Woman abusing Bill O'Reilly. Former Fox News host, racist bigot, who was ousted for sexually harassing women. As it is, the parent company, Sinclair, forces their affiliates to play clips from this abomination.
And that's the bottom line.
Boris Epstein, former Trump and White House staffer and frequent television surrogate, and every Sinclair affiliate's chief political analyst. This that you're about to hear will be feeding into 72% of households every single night.
As the Trump administration considers ways to improve its messaging, one area that may see change is the White House daily press briefing.
Our chief political analyst, Boris Epstein, who is a former senior Trump campaign advisor and administration official, gives his insights and commentary about what changes may be coming.
From the very start of the Trump presidency, the press briefings have veered way off course. They've become much more theater than information gathering. Theater in which, frankly, the press has often played the leading role.
Boris Epstein on Charlottesville.
I know what it is like to live in a country where the leaders are anti-Semitic. This is not it. The president stating the fact that the fringes of the left and the right are both capable of hate and violence does not mean he's condoning any of it.
Boris Epstein on voter fraud.
It is important to note that voter fraud goes beyond stealing or miscounting ballots. Intentionally improper voter registration is absolutely a type of voter fraud. The Commission on Election Integrity has gotten to work, and one of its first public actions is drawing scrutiny
on Democrats voting to repeal Obamacare.
It's going to be difficult to get Democrats on board here because Barack Obama, back in January before he left, gave the Democrats a pep talk, said, no matter what happens, don't get on board with repealing, replacing Obamacare in any sort of way. So that'll be difficult on this.
On quote-unquote fake news.
It's also important to further focus on CNN's digital presence. The network's website is supposed to be delivering news. However, it is dominated by opinion-based headlines and articles with more commentary than impartial fact. The bottom line is this. CNN, along with other cable news networks, is struggling to stick to the facts and to be impartial in covering politics in general and this president specifically.
On tax reform.
The administration, together with the House and the Senate, are continuing to forge ahead on making real change to the tax code. It is clear that there is a commitment to tax reform. However, it does appear that the repeal and replace of Obamacare has to get done first, with tax reform falling right behind. And that's the bottom line.
And it doesn't stop with our friend Boris here. Here is Mark Hyman, commentator, piping into your local news.
I've got a message for certain students. Listen up closely, Snowflake. Yes, I'm talking to you. You, the social justice warrior who whines for trigger warnings and safe spaces, not grown up enough to deal with the facts, then hunker down in your room and Snapchat the day away with other social justice warriors. College isn't a babysitting service. It's time to grow up, Snowflake.
We are threatened by a nasty cancer epidemic. It's a danger to our nation. It is political correctness and multiculturalism. Words that were once acceptable in polite conversation are no longer. Handicapped and retarded are now off limits. There is one step that's proven to dramatically reduce domestic violence. Marriage. I am now a proud Washington Redskins fan. And the opinion that only black people can legitimately have an afro? Someone should tell that to American folk singer Art Garfunkel.
This is a profound horror story, the consequences of which are facing all the way to the fall of America. I hope I'm being hyperbolic, but look at the damage Fox News has done over the years. Can you imagine what this is going to do? Let's follow this tragic news up with some news. Ending Wall Street, its first major win since President Twinklefingers took office in January. Tuesday night, Republicans voted to repeal a rule that made it easier for Americans to sue their banks and credit card companies. Because this is exactly what the people who voted them in wanted, right? Vice President Sexually Oppressed Mikey Pence, who, need I remind everybody, calls his wife mother, got to do something. And he got to cast the tie-breaking vote.
Woohoo!
Congratulations, Mikey. You're moving up in this world. We are in the midst of disaster capitalism in action. And we're up against a scandal or at least what should be a scandal. But this one is today, well, just another day. It has to do with an energy company called Whitefish. The WAPA reports that Whitefish was awarded a $300 million no-bid contract to restore the power grid to Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico.
So get this. When Hurricane Maria hit, this lucky company had only two,
count them, two
employees. It is based in Whitefish, Montana, the hometown of Interior Secretary, polar bear hater, and oil lover Ryan Zinke. Andy Tuchmansky is the Whitefish chief executive, and one of Zinke's sons joined a friend who worked a summer job at one of Tuchmansky's construction sites. Not only that, Whitefish is backed by private equity HBC Investments, which is headed by Joel Colonetta, a major donor to the worst president in history's election campaign. The Trump Victory PAC, and other GOP candidates. No, nothing shady here. Not at all. All of this sounds totally on the up and up for sure. At least there's this. USA Today reports that Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosello, wants the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security to look into this ill-gotten contract. In addition to the Inspector General's review of the contract, the governor has asked his own Office of Management and Budget to audit the Whitefish contract and make sure it followed Puerto Rico and federal law. NPR says that the task of rebuilding Puerto Rico's power grid is expected to take months and will cost as much as $5 billion. So Whitefish could be a very happy company indeed. We will have to see how the cookie crumbles on this situation. Since we're talking about Puerto Rico, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, of course, is refusing to release a document drafted several years ago that details how it would respond to a major hurricane in Puerto Rico. According to ProPublica, the plan known as Hurricane Annex runs more than 100 pages and explains exactly what FEMA and other agencies would do in the event that a large storm struck the island. The document could help experts assess how well the federal government had prepared for a storm the size of Hurricane Maria and whether FEMA's response matches what was planned. The agency began drafting such advanced plans after it was exonerated for poor performance and lack of preparation in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And this shady behavior with FEMA is not new. FEMA's Freedom of Information process is plagued by dysfunction and years of backlogs. For example, FEMA hasn't responded to a request for documents related to Superstorm Sandy that were filed more than 3.5 years ago. Yet, ProPublica found proudly posted on the interwebs the agency's equivalent plan for Hawaii, posted, unredacted, on the internet, by the Department of Defense. The Hawaiian plan includes granular details down to, for example, how many specialty outfitted medical aircraft the federal government would need to send to Hawaii after a Category 4 hurricane. It also describes an 85-step process to restore electricity to the islands. So why not Puerto Rico? What are they hiding?
Accountability?
What? Vox reports that the nation's largest nurses union condemned the federal government's emergency response in Puerto Rico on Thursday for, quote, delaying necessary humanitarian aid to its citizens and leaving them to die, unquote. This comes from the members of the nonprofit National Nurses United speaking on Capitol Hill with Democratic members of Congress after a 2-week humanitarian mission in Puerto Rico. Almost 50 volunteered nurses visited 24 towns in urban and rural areas. They described the desperation of Puerto Ricans even 5 weeks after Hurricane Maria hit the island as worse than anything they had witnessed in other humanitarian missions, including the aftermath of Katrina in New Orleans and the earthquake in Haiti. So these nurses, they described performing surgery in hospitals with the light from their frickin' cell phones. They told about children screaming from hunger, elderly residents suffering from severe dehydration, and of course, black mold spreading throughout the entire community. Nurses arrived in towns that never got food or water supplies or any other help from FEMA. Some communities the nurses visited did get supplies, but were not getting enough. And still, 75% of the island doesn't have electricity and 25% still doesn't have running water. An outbreak of leptospirosis, which is a dangerous bacterial disease, has already claimed lives, and multiple communities without clean water are at risk of an outbreak of waterborne illness epidemics. But at least it's not all grim news. Tesla has stepped up to the challenge.
By the way, my brother just got a Tesla, and it's amazing.
Tesla has used its solar panels and batteries to restore reliable electricity to San Juan's Hospital del Niño. It's a children's hospital. The company's founder, Elon Musk, says that it is the first of many solar battery Tesla products going live in Puerto Rico. So, yay! Keep looking for the helpers, because they're there. If in short supply. In other news, this Republican government of ours has successfully turned the EPA into an arm of the energy industry. And now the Environmental Protection Agency, instead of, you know, protecting the environment, it is now protecting its administrator, EPA director, and wool suit filled with oatmeal, Scott Pruitt. CNN reports that according to a source with knowledge of the situation, Pruitt's security detail is in the process of expanding by hiring a dozen more agents. So not only are they slashing the EPA's budget by 30%, the salaries alone for the full security team will cost $2 million per year. And that doesn't factor in travel and training. These special agents are being pulled from their regular post investigating environmental crime. These agents are armed federal law enforcement officers who typically investigate cases such as dumping of hazardous waste, improper disposal of dangerous substances like asbestos, and pollution of drinking water. Some are former FBI agents. The EPA's Inspector General's office said it has been asked to investigate whether Pruitt's security detail is a proper use of environmental enforcement officers, and whether the practice detracts from the agency's mission of cracking down on environmental crimes.
Which, of course, it is.
And it's heartbreaking. And still, it's not all bad news. There are people fighting our conservative government in every corner of America. Let's go back to Montana. Consider Anaconda, Deer Lodge County in Montana, founded in 1965, and as of the 2010 census, had a population of 9,298. Deer Lodge County is standing up against the administration's, well, really, against the Secretary of the Interior, oil company shill, and Montana native Ryan Zinke's plans to sell off their public lands. Their lands are the area's primary source of income. Charlie Pierce of Esquire reports, quote, "Small though it is, the country has had its share of environmental concerns. For example, Anaconda was stuck on the county's name as an acknowledgement of the local activities of the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, a corporate behemoth that dominated local politics from the late 19th to the mid-20th century. Because of the disfigurement of the state's politics by the influence brought by this one company, in 1912, the state passed a law forbidding any corporate contributions in the state elections. However, this law was one of the first casualties of the Supreme Court's ill-fated decision to legalize influence and peddling through its Citizens United decision. The country has another, more obvious legacy from Anaconda's glory days, and that is 300 square miles of the southern end of Deer Lodge Valley has been an EPA Superfund site since 1983. There have been more than 30 such resolutions passed in the western states over the past 2 years. Generally, they have been the product of thriving coalitions between sportsmen and environmentalists, which is something to celebrate in this divisive age. The Anaconda Deer Lodge resolution even warns that a warming climate tends to accentuate the process of regular forest fires that are essential to the local ecosystem. This, of course, is something that Scott Pruitt is deliberately expunging from EPA publications and EPA science. I'm sure he'll have something to say from the bomb-proof bunker where he's working at the moment. Unquote. So before I go on with the news, I need to get this out. We have a call to action.
Call to action.
Call to action.
Call to action.
Call to actions.
Calls to actions.
Call to action.
Republican members of Congress. Huh. There's that beginning to a horror movie again.
Republicans in the House.
Don't you dare touch me! Stand back! No! No!
Republican members of Congress are continuing their radical attacks on reproductive rights by moving forward with a bill that blocks access to abortions before most women even know they're pregnant. The House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice scheduled a hearing for November 1st to discuss the Heartbeat Protection Act of 2017, H.R. 490. So this heartbeat bill effectively bans abortions starting 6 weeks into a pregnancy by making it a crime for a physician to knowingly perform an abortion without determining whether the fetus has a detectable heartbeat, without informing the mother of the results, or after determining that the fetus has a detectable heartbeat. So did you catch that? They can't perform an abortion without determining if the fetus has a detectable heartbeat. And if they do detect a heartbeat, then they can't perform the abortion. And usually, the heartbeat is detectable around 6 to 7 weeks. The sole exception to the ban is for an abortion, which is medically necessary to save the life of the woman, ignoring a woman's psychological state, even in instances of rape or incest.
This is outrageous.
Your member of Congress needs to hear from you that the heartbeat bill is a horrifying, extreme attack on reproductive health and a woman's right to choose. Tell your member of Congress to stand up for women and families and oppose the heartbeat bill. Call the switchboard at 202-225-3121. And if you have a Republican rep, tell them to not be women-hating assholes. Or if you have a Democrat, thank them for not being dicks. Again, that's 202-225-3121. So, Thursday was grandstanding against opioids day on Capitol Hill. It's like all of a sudden our government realized that white Republicans struggle with addiction too. So instead of tossing addicts in jail, they're going to offer treatment.
Kind of.
Not really.
That's what they're saying.
In a way. Not quite breaking from the Republican long-standing tradition of the war on drugs, which punished the drug users to the tune of militarized police and a jailed generation of Americans, our president made sweeping new promises to mobilize the federal government against the deadly opioid epidemic. But his language contrasted sharply with the actual order that stopped well short of a major new commitment of resources for a crisis that last year killed more than 64,000 Americans. So Donald directed the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to declare a 90-day public health emergency. Meanwhile, this inept carnival of an administration doesn't have a permanent Health and Human Services secretary or a director of the Drug Enforcement Administration, and Donald's pick for drug czar, Representative Tom Marino, recently withdrew his nomination
after it came out that he was a patsy for the drug industry.
He had sponsored legislation which hindered the Drug Enforcement Administration in its fight against none other than the opioid crisis. So the Orange Ruffian declared a nationwide public health emergency rather than issuing a national disaster declaration, a designation that will not automatically be followed by additional federal funding for the crisis.
It's toothless.
And at the same time, Donald and his Republican lackeys have worked for most of the year to roll back the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which has helped many states on the front lines of the epidemic expand treatment for patients with substance abuse disorder, also known as substance use disorder, SUD. And let's be clear, addiction is a disorder. Our society has taken a huge step forward on this view of addiction. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, only 1 in 10 addicted Americans,
1 in 10, are getting specialty treatment.
In recent years, funding made available through the Affordable Care Act has allowed states including Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky to open Medicaid to poor, working-age adults, a population traditionally not eligible for coverage, but often most likely to face substance abuse issues. More than a third of the approximately 700,000 people who enrolled in Medicaid after the expansion began in 2014 reported some drug or alcoholic dependence, according to the recent study by the state. The vast majority did not previously have health insurance. The worst part is, the most specific his speech got was when he advocated for spending more money on educating youth to flat out refuse drugs. Anyone having a flashback to Nancy Reagan's famous Just Say No campaigns of the 80s?
Okay.
No thanks.
Yo, my man, you want some nudes?
No way.
If someone offers you drugs, instead of saying something you really don't mean, just say
no.
Donald promised a massive advertising campaign to get people, especially children, not to take drugs in the first place. He basically wants to bring back the failed DARE program.
I will dare.
DARE. Drug Abuse Resistance Education, a program developed in the 1980s by Los Angeles police and educators that involved officers warning students about the consequences of drug use. The joke was on everyone, as studies published in 2002 and 2009 found that DARE was ineffective and sometimes counterproductive. It often found that teens who participated in DARE or similar programs actually had a higher likelihood of drinking or smoking than students who had not undergone the educational initiative. And the moralizing of the campaigns was absolutely counterproductive.
Of course, your local drug pusher may tell you a little something different about these drugs, and who you believe is up to you. But then again, if you go ahead and try them, at least it won't be out of ignorance. Just stupidity.
Not unlike the kind of moralizing that our president engaged in his speech Thursday.
The fact is, if we can teach young people and people generally not to start, it's really, really easy not to take them.
Nationally, and especially on the conservative side, but it's on the liberal side too. People seem to love to assert their moral authority over addicts. Even people who casually use drugs or alcohol feel superior to those who become addicted. After any celebrity overdoses and dies, we'll see a rash of tweets and Facebook comments that read,
"I have no sympathy,"
and "he did it to himself," and "he knew the risk," and words are used like weak and,
selfish
are used to describe and dismiss the man, dehumanizing him as an addict.
He's no better than a filthy immoral less than who deserves his fate by virtue of his failing.
It's very puritanical, this societal discomfort with anything that falls outside the accepted norm, isn't it? And this view has a crippling effect on those struggling with addiction. Coming forward and asking for help is hard.
It is scary, and being faced with the possibility of being met with such a reaction
can be enough to prevent a person who desperately needs help from receiving it. It's a matter of life and death. I am a recovering addict, and as much as I enjoy hearing someone who has never been afflicted with the disorder tell me that I should have just never started in the first place, I don't really find it helpful. The DARE program and Just Say No told kids like myself that drugs were a defect rather than a symptom, immoral rather than a societal failure. DARE and Just Say No spread fear and ignorance instead of information, placing all responsibility on the individual while denying them the tools they need to make key decisions. Not unlike abstinence-based sex education. Donald actually said that, quote, "There's nothing desirable about drugs. They're bad," unquote.
Oh, really? Speak for yourself, you freak of nature.
I got into my addiction late, towards the end of my 20s. It crept up on me as I was seeking ways to self-medicate for my depression, which was particularly severe during those years. At the time, I had not found legal medications to help with the symptoms. I was so desperate to feel something other than the pain of my emotions, to ease my crippling anxiety and quiet the pervasive lies of my spinning dark thoughts. I reached for the only thing I could to keep myself from harming, or frankly, killing myself. And the addiction, slowly, over half a decade, took hold. It was like the thing I had found to give myself control, slowly, bit by bit, started to take control of me. By the time I realized I was dependent, it was too late. I was addicted. And even that realization, with the knowledge that I was only going to go downhill from there, it still took me 2 years for things to get bad enough that I had no choice but to seek help. I was met with compassion and understanding in my journey to sobriety. Even my brother, who is one of those rare people who has never tried a drug or alcohol, had nothing but compassion and support for me. Not all addicts are so lucky. I'm willing to bet not most. I promise you, had I been told my addiction was due to a moral weakness, or had I been met with the ignorance that says I just should have never started in the first place, I would have snuck right back into my old habits. Because the last thing an addict needs is to be shamed. Addicts, by and large, are struggling with more shame than people can imagine. I have little hopes that these efforts will be anything better than the 1980s war on drugs. In August, our president said stronger law enforcement responses needed to combat the opioid crisis. He lamented that the overall drug prosecutions had gone down in recent years, and the facts that at the end of 2016, there were 23% fewer federal prosecutions than in 2011, and the average sentence for a drug offender decreased from 20% from 2009 to 2016.
It's nothing less than a clarion call for the war on drugs.
Stricter enforcement has never worked. People do illegal things as long as they think they can get away with it. As of 2015, according to the Bureau of Prisons, there was 207,847 people incarcerated in federal prisons. Roughly half, 48.6%, were in for drug offenses. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, there are 1,358,875 people in state prisons. Of them, 16% have a drug crime as their worst serious offense. All arresting a person does is limit their opportunities in life, increase their depression and shame, and set them loose with no tools or understanding to combat their addiction. What we need to do is focus on the treatment side of things. Donald promises to quote, "be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic," unquote. And yet his plans simply seem to be a weak-kneed rehash of failed policies, and the entire country is the loser for it. Thank you guys for listening. I really appreciate it. You can find my show on crabdiving.com, that's crabdiving.com, under the K-Voice tab, or download my show as a podcast wherever it is you get your podcast, and find me on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. And of course, on Twitter, at Kelly the Voice. Take care of yourselves out there. And as always, resist.